So here's that same idea now with respect to the old McDonald song. And I think I probably made this way more complicated than I should have. But here's what I did. First, the easy thing here is I made a subroutine called make noise that you give as a parameter whatever noise you want it to make. So, you know, nay or rough or cock-a-doodle-doo. Pick your favorite noise. And what it'll do with that noise, it'll print with A and then make that noise, dash, make that noise again, here, and A, make that noise again, there, here a noise, there a noise, everywhere a noise noise. Okay? So it's just what you'd think you'd need if you were creating an old McDonald function. Most operating systems, as far as I can tell, don't have this built in. I don't know why, because it's clearly very useful. All right, so that's the simple subroutine. Now we have, let's see, we have a much more complicated subroutine, which is this doIntro. So doIntro is actually given three different parameters. And if you don't follow all this right now, it could be because you're not quite getting this notion of parameters, but I suspect that's not it. I suspect I just made this too complicated. But nevertheless, here's what I did. So you give it the name of an animal, the noise that that animal makes, and whether or not this is the first time you're singing about that animal. Because it turns out in the old McDonald song, that matters. So this is a Boolean variable. This is either true or false. Just like the A's and B's that we've been talking about for the last couple weeks. So now I haven't told you about this, but this is a statement called if. So if tests whatever whatever expression you give it, it's either true or false. If that thing is true, then it does this block. Otherwise, it doesn't. So in this case, if we're in the intro, if we tell it we're in the intro, then it's going to print, old McDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, and on this farm he had a name of animal goes here, E-I-E-I-O. Then it's going to do make noise, right? So if we put in dog, say we put in dog, rough, true, it's going to sing, old McDonald had a, not literally sing, E-I-E-I-O, and on this farm he had a dog, E-I-E-I-O, and then it's going to do the make noise subroutine, which will call down here, and it'll say, with a bark, bark here, and a bark, bark there, a bark, there, bark, everywhere, bark, bark. Then it will come back, and then say, if it's the intro, it's going to say, old McDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, blank line, end. All right. If it's not an intro, it just makes the noise. It doesn't sing this before part or the after part. All right, now how are we going to use this? We're going to say, let's see. We're going to make a cow subroutine. The cow subroutine does the introduction with the cow and the moo. Oh, sorry. The moo subroutine takes as input whether or not this is the first time we're dealing with cows or not. And if there is, then we do the intro with cow and moo saying, yes, we're doing, yes, this is the first time we're singing it. Otherwise, if we put in false for here, it's going to end up singing the cows, just the cow noise and nothing else. We do the same thing with pig, or snort in this case. Snort will cause it to do the pig intro, but when it's done that, it will do the moo subroutine with intro set to false. In other words, it'll make the cow noise. Neigh does the horse intro, then it does the snort song, sub-song, without the intro. So this will actually cause it to do the pig noise and the cow noise. Almost done. Then finally, the cluck subroutine will cause it to sing the intro about chickens or chicks. With cluck cluck here and cluck up there, then it'll go in and do everything having to do with horses, including the something about pigs and something about cows. When all is said and done, it will actually sing, this will sing the whole old McDonald song. Oh, so sorry, now the old McDonald song is do the moo verse, do the snort verse, including the intro, do the neigh verse, including the intro, do the cluck verse, including the intro. And it turns out that there's even more complicated ways and much briefer ways of writing the same thing, but this is pretty much all that we were ready for at this point. And maybe even more than we were ready for. Any questions about that other than why? There's no why. Yeah? Is that it?
Well, yeah, okay.
Sure, good. Break the ice, go for it.
How does the program know where to look for the parameters? Does it have to be in the same file?
We always, whenever we call a subroutine, we have to fill in what the parameters are. So in particular, right here, when we call the cluck subroutine, we actually have to say cluck, and we have to tell it that the intro value is true right now. So there's nothing else missing. There's no parameter files or buttons you have to push. This is self-contained. If we now call old MacDonald with no parameters, it'll sing the whole song with all the sub pieces. All right, so this just for your own edification, is more or less what I said verbally, except written out so you have it in the notes. So essentially, this is how the subroutine stack, this is how it actually works at runtime. So when we call the old MacDonald subroutine, it does the move first, and then it does the snort first. And just so you see exactly what that means, it calls snort, which involves doing the intro, including the pig noises. Then it calls the move subroutine with the intro set to false, which means all it's going to do is sing about cows and then come back. So I didn't give you the full, anyway, it's not so important. But here's the important thing. These subroutines have a notion of local variables. In particular, let's see, do I have this written someplace else? Yeah, so this is an important point right here. That notice that each subroutine has its own copy of a variable called intro. But they're all personal local copies. Even though they all have the same name, the moo subroutine's notion of intro is different from the nay's subroutine's notion of intro. They have their own copies of those variables. And they can do whatever they want to them locally. And changing one of them locally doesn't have any effect on the other one. It's like different families can have, this is my brother, what was it? My brother Bob and my other brother Bob. Did anybody watch the TV show Newhart?
Daryl,
thank you. All right, so, but of course, if no one's seen it, this means nothing. So a family can have a Daryl in it, and another family can have a Daryl in it. And there's no confusion, because this is Daryl Jones, and this is Daryl Smith, right? This is the variable for this subroutine, this is the intro variable for a different subroutine. So even though they have the same name, you don't have to necessarily assume that it's talking about the same object. What's funny about the Newhart example is there was a character on the show who would always walk with his two mostly silent brothers, and he would say, "This is my brother Daryl and my other brother Daryl." So this is a family in which there was a man and then two brothers, and they both had the name Daryl. Which is funny because no one would ever do that. It makes no sense. All right, so let's see. Unless otherwise specified, variable names refer to their values within the subroutine itself only. Changes to these local variables do not impact any of the calling subroutines. They have their own little local copy. So this is my take on the Las Vegas slogan. What happens in local variable stays in local variable. It's just its own little happy bubble. Another story is I have a friend whose marriage fell apart because of something that he did in Las Vegas that he won't tell me what it is. So apparently this is not entirely true, this whole thing about Las Vegas. But with local variables, it's much more true. Just so you know. All right. So this is where it gets a little bit mind-bending. This notion of recursion. So since each subroutine call has its own context, its own local variables that refer just to what that subroutine is working on at that time, and it also has its red arrow, right, sort of where it is, where it currently is in the execution of that subroutine, it's perfectly reasonable for a subroutine to call itself, to say, hey, you know what, I've got a subproblem that only I can solve, and so it makes basically a copy of itself that's now going to work on some subproblem, and it's going to work for a while, and then it's going to come back to its copy. So this whole cloning, human cloning maybe is a problem, but subroutine cloning is fine, and it's called recursion. So I'm going to give you an example of this in the context of a song, and then I'll show you something that's actually much more powerful in general that we use in computer science more often. So here's a recursive algorithm. It's based on a song called 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall, which I'm hoping people are familiar with, even if you haven't seen the Newhart show. It's hard to avoid the 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall song. So the 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall song, here, I'll do it for three Bottles of Beer on the Wall song, in case you haven't heard it before. It goes, three bottles of beer on the wall, three bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, two bottles of beer on the wall, two bottles of beer on the wall, two bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, one bottles of beer on the wall, that's a bug in this part. One bottles of beer on the wall, one bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, zero bottles of beer on the wall, and then it ends. So that's the song that we'd like to produce. So how would we do that? Well, one way to do that is when we want to do, say, 99 bottles of Durnall, which I will not subject you to at this time, but it would be easy to write a program that would not get bored and actually would do the whole thing. To do 99 bottles of beer, it prints a message. It prints 99 bottles of beer on the wall, 99 bottles of beer. One of those bottles should happen to fall. 98 bottles of beer on the wall. Then there's still more to sing. It now has to sing the whole song starting from 98. So then it's going to call bottles of beer 98, which sings the whole song starting from 98, which starts off by printing a message. And then to do the rest of the song, it calls itself saying, now I need to know what the song sounds like through 97 bottles of beer on the wall. It does all that. And eventually it works its all the way down to 0 bottles of the beer on the wall, which actually is not a song at all. It's just silent. So how do you sing 0 bottles of beer on the wall? There, I just did it. There's nothing to it. So here's how you actually write that as a Python function. So we call bottles of beer with some number n. And we ask, well, is that number greater than 0? If it's not greater than 0, we're not going to do anything. But if it's greater than 0, then what we're going to do is print the number written as a string. Don't worry about that. But it's printing n, whatever n is, bottles of beer on the wall. Then it's going to print that again, bottles of beer. If one of those bottles should happen to fall, now this is not an if statement. This is just the word if. Then it's going to print n minus 1 bottles of beer on the wall, right? If it was 99, it'll print 98. If it was 97, it'll print 96. Then it will print a blank line, and then it proceeds by calling the next smaller bottles of beer on the wall song, which causes it to start this all over again from scratch, but with one smaller number. This, even though to sing the bottles of beer on the wall song, we have to sing the bottles of beer on the wall song, it sounds circular, right? You're not supposed to do that when you're defining words, but defining a subroutine, it's okay as long as it will eventually stop. And the reason, how do we know that this will eventually stop? Why can't it go forever?
N greater than 0.
So this test is really important for that, right? In fact, my first version of this program left that out. So what happens if you leave this out? My kids just love this. They watched it scroll on the screen for a while and laughed at their idiot father. It will go 5 bottles of beer on the wall, 4 bottles of beer on the wall, 3 bottles of beer on the wall, 2 bottles of beer on the wall, 1 bottle of beer on the wall, 0 bottles of beer on the wall, negative 1 bottle of beer on the wall, negative 2 bottles of beer on the wall, negative 3 bottles of beer on the wall, until you just have to stop the computer. Which you can do with a hammer, but there's usually a keystroke that will do the same thing. So here, this is what makes it stop. Eventually, since the numbers are getting smaller and smaller, it's always taking whatever the number is and subtracting 1 from it, that number will eventually go below 0. There's no number that we can start with that if you subtract 1 from it enough times, it won't eventually hit 0. You could make this run for a very long time by putting in, 10 billion or something like that, right? And we'll happily do that until you stop it or it gets down to 0. Okay, I think I have an example next before I give up. No, I guess not. All right, so any questions about this? This example is not a hard example because you sort of understand how it's just ticking down one after the other. But in general, these recursive calls can actually really get freaky. But I think this is an okay, understandable example. Makes me want to ask a clicker question or something. Is anyone not getting this? Who's willing to take one for the team? Okay, so what could I ask to see that you're actually getting that? So we'll make a little recursive subroutine.
Maybe give them multiple choice to figure out a base case that will stop it. That would be a good understanding.
Yeah, that would be good. I'll try a simple one like this first. See what that is. Alright, so we're gonna say def r of x if x is less than it's greater than 1. R of 64. So which sequence of numbers does this, would this print out? We define a routine R this way that actually calls itself. Then, actually just make it correct pythons, do that. Then we call that subroutine with the number 64. Does it print the number 64? Does it print the series 64, 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1, a half, a quarter, and then keep running forever? Does it print 64, 63, 62, 61, 60, all the way down to 2? Does it print 64, 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1, or 64, 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, and stop there? Okay? Yes? Oh, now I get questions? Yeah, go ahead. What?
Oh, well, after.
Yeah, all right. I'll start collecting data now. This off in 5 seconds. Okay. All right, what was your question? You got it? Okay. All right. So here's what this should do. It should take x as input. If that number x is bigger than 1, then it's going to do something. If it's not bigger than 1, it doesn't do anything. So anything 1 or smaller isn't going to happen. But if it's bigger than 1, it's going to print that number, some number bigger than 1, then it's going to halve it, divide by 2, and then it's going to start over again from scratch. So if we started off with 64, it's going to do 64, then it's going to print 64, it's going to halve that to 32 and start over from scratch. Now x is 32. It's going to print 32, 16, 8, 4, 2, then it's going to divide that in half to get 1. It's going to come up here. 1 is not greater than 1, so it's not going to do that. It will stop. The last thing it prints will be 2. So that would be E, which was more commonly chosen than the others. D is close, right? So the only difference between D and E is the question is, what does this do if given the input 1? And the answer is, it won't. It won't do anything. It'll just stop, because at 1 is not bigger than 1. So if you put D instead of E, that may have been what you didn't realize. A couple of people put B, which is, well, at least nobody put C. Well, not nobody, sorry, one person put C. Yes, go ahead.
I thought it would put the answer on half of 2. So it would print 1, but I thought it would go beyond 1 because it's like,
right, so let's look at why it doesn't. So what if you call R with the value 1? So x is equal to 1. The first thing it's going to do is a test to say, is that number 1 bigger than 1? The answer will be no, so it won't actually print it.
Right. But I'm saying I thought it would print the answer.
Well, I don't know what the answer means. I'm just following the instructions that the computer was following.
But if it is 2 and you plug in...
If it's 2, let's see what happens with 2. If x comes in as 2, is 2 bigger than 1? Yes. It's going to print 2. Then it's going to figure out what 2 divided by 2 is, which is 1, and use that as the call value for R.
It's just going to make sure that x is bigger than 1 before it prints it then.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And in particular, if it's not bigger than 1, the whole game stops. But if it is bigger than 1, not only is it going to print that value, but it's going to go back in and take the new value and work with that. So that's sort of what happens here. I guess I feel confident enough that we could go on. But if you have any additional questions based on trying to figure this out, this would be a very good time to ask. Shoot.
If you at the end of that, if you printed print R, like that would print a new R.
Well, there's no R. R is a function. Oh, if we print it where? Inside the inside the if or outside the if?
Inside of it.
It would be different in those two cases. If we did this,
it would print one then.
It would not print one. No. You're saying instead of this line or in addition to this line?
In addition.
So this is a little bit interesting. So if we do.
But if you put print R, then it would print the one, right?
If you put print R on the bottom.
There's no, but R is not a printable thing. R is a command. It's like, no, brush your teeth. It doesn't have a value. X is a number, like 7. Or
if you just go down that with 2.
Yeah. So in particular, this is, even though it's taking X and dividing it by 2, it's just, it's figuring out that answer. But it's not changing the value of X.
Right.
Because this copy of R that gets called has its own local copy of X. And what happens there stays there. It doesn't affect the caller.
Okay, so you can't print the new value of X?
As far as this subroutine is concerned, there is no new value of X. It hasn't changed. All that change happened was inside a different copy of R. This is the part that's a little freakish, right? So in particular, one way to look at this is, look, so we're inside a call to R where X has the value 2, okay? And what happens in here is it prints X, but then it calls R of X over 2, which based on the same kind of pictures I was doing for the old McDonald's, we get on the stack, we get a new R, and in that R, X is equal to 1. So here, when it prints X, it's not gonna print 1 because X is not bigger than 1, so it's gonna test if X is bigger than 1, do some stuff. But since it's not going to do anything. It's just going to return. And the value of X that we had in here is a different X than the one that we had in here. So the fact that it was 1 here doesn't mean that it's 1 in here. It's a different X. It's a local variable. Local meaning just here. Okay?
What would you do after that to me? Set a new value for that.
We could just say X equals X divided by 2.
Yeah, I think you
could
do
could
that.
Say that, sure. See, here's an interesting thing. I won't do this as a clicker question. But let's look at this version of the subroutine. What if we do this instead? This is now saying we come in with some value of X. If X is bigger than 1, we recursively call R with X half. Then we print X afterwards. After it comes back to whatever it's going to do in there, then we print X. What will that do? Can anybody? I'm not going to ask everybody to answer on their own, but if anybody in the room can answer it, I'd be really happy to hear the answer. It's not any of these choices. It's a whole new thing. Not a whole new thing, but it's, if we call R of, say we call R of 8. It's twisteder than that. So you're going to say what, 4 and then 8? Like
no,
that? Or just 4 by itself? Or 4, 2, 1, like that? 4, 2.
4, 2.
You think 4, 2, 1?
No, just 4, 2.
4, 2. Because we already explained why 1 won't print.
I'm
going to
start with 8.
It'll still print 8.
It will print 8.
Yeah, it would just print
the question 8. Is when will it print 8?
Beginning.
No, well, look, no, not anymore. So now we're going to test if it's bigger than 1, and if it's not, sorry, if it's bigger than 1, then we do everything on, we do R of 4. Whatever that's going to do is going to do, and when it's done, it's going to come back to us, and then we're going to print 8. The very last thing it does before the game's over for this guy is it prints 8. So where should the 8 be? What's that?
Yeah.
In the end, right? The last thing it prints is 8. But what does it print before that?
2.
It's going to print a 2. So is that the answer now? 2 and then 8? It's going to print 4 also.
4, 2, 8.
4, 2, 8. No. 248? What's that? 248. Why?
Oh, I don't know.
Because that was one that we hadn't thrown out yet. Okay, that's a good choice. This is a little weird, and I appreciate that not everyone's gonna, this isn't gonna lock in for everybody right away, so don't sweat. But it is, it's weird to think about it, and it's a good exercise to think about it a little bit. So here's the way to think about it. This routine, given any number, it does something, and then the last thing it does is prints that number. So we figured out that 8 is definitely gonna be the last thing it prints. But what the thing that it's doing before it prints 8 is R of 4. Well, what's R of 4 gonna do? We do the same analysis. Whatever it's going to do 4 last, right? So R of 8 is going to do R of 4, and then it's going to print 8, okay? Well, what does R of 4 do? R of 4 is going to do R of 2, and then it's going to print 4. Well, what's R of 2 going to do? R of 2 is going to do R of 1, then it's going to print 2. What's R of 1 going to do? Nothing. R of 1 doesn't do anything. It's just because it's not bigger than 1. It just stops. So, stringing all these together, R of 2 just prints 2. R of 4 prints 2 and then 4. R of 8 prints 2, then 4, then 8. So yeah, it's 2, then 4, then 8. It's going to print the numbers in reverse order. That's a little weird. All that we did is we changed the order of these two lines, and it actually flipped the whole sequence of numbers around. So if we did R of 64, it will actually go 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. All right, I'll let that sit on everybody for a little while. But I don't know, that's one of the weird, this is why recursion is challenging to think about. No, I was trying to emphasize that. I understand that this is not, yeah, this is probably, to really get you to get this would require you writing lots of hard recursive programs, and we're not going to spend time on that, because I really want to give you a sense of a lot of different things in computer science. So don't worry if that doesn't sit. In fact, the weird thing, I don't know if this happened to any of your friends here, but when I was in college, I was in a class where we really did recursion really hard, and we really tried to wrap our brains around it. People started to dream recursively. It was a lot of people were embarrassed to tell each other, but once the word was out, everyone was like, yeah, that happened to me too. It's one of these things that does weird things to your brain. Now, of course, I'm completely normal now. But did anybody report that? Not you, of course.
No.
Okay, then it might have just been me and my friends. But nevertheless, I think major brain shifts are necessary to really get this. But nevertheless, I want you to at least know that there is this weird thing that you can do that actually has a lot of power. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about everyday recursion. So I would say recursion, really getting recursion from a programming standpoint is kind of hard and maybe scary to some people. But there's lots of things that we use in life that have recursive relationships that we're perfectly comfortable with. So this happens in language all the time. You have sentences that are actually inside of other sentences that are inside of other sentences. And that doesn't really bother us unless you go very, very deep. Lots of things in nature, leaf patterns and trees, they look like little leaves and trees if you look at the pieces of them. So a leaf consists of a leaf, which consists of a leaf. Certain toys like these, I think they're called mamushka dolls. Say it again.
Madryoshka.
Thank you. Very nice. The Russian nesting dolls, where it's a doll that you open it up, and inside there's a doll that looks just like the first one, except smaller. What happens when you open that one up? It's a doll, just like the first and the second one, only smaller. It just keeps, inside of each doll is a smaller version of itself. This is a cutaway of broccoli. So notice what broccoli looks like, and notice what pieces of the broccoli look like. It looks like a broccoli. And notice what a piece of that piece looks like. It's another broccoli. When you do it with shapes, people call recursion fractals. So if you heard the word fractal, fractal is referring to this notion of recursion applied to shapes, applied to space. Family trees are like this too, right? I mean, you have a father who had a father who had a father who had a father, and you can talk about the father's 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 father. Each piece of a family tree looks like a little family tree. Mathematical expressions, and I'm going to talk more about logic expressions in particular, just because they're simple, also have this kind of recursive structure. Expression is made up of other expressions. So this is not anything that you haven't thought about before. You just haven't really tamed it, right? You haven't used it to your advantage, but it's something that you're certainly aware of and comfortable with. Since I keep going back to the Beatles, I thought it was funny that there's Madrioska dolls of the Beatles. All right. Recursion, one of the things about recursion is it gives you a way of shooting yourself in the foot really hard. And so this is an example of a song that actually has a broken version of recursion in it. I don't know if people know this song. I first encountered this song on a show called Glam Chops Play Along. But it's, let me play it for you. Oh, I can't play it for you. The sound is off. So what's happening here, other than it pissing everybody off? So how do you sing the song that doesn't end? Well, to sing the song that doesn't end, you sing these lines, and at the end of it, you begin by singing, or you finish by singing the song that doesn't end, which of course goes back to the top and starts doing this again, and when it's all over, it calls itself and does the song again. This is a song that doesn't end literally, right? This is a program that's actually going to keep printing forever. Yeah.
So it's like a loop?
It's a loop. It's what's called an infinite loop. It's a loop that never stops, never terminates. So computer scientists like that shampoo bottles say lather, rinse, repeat, right? How do you shampoo your hair? You shampoo your hair by lathering, and then rinsing, and then by shampooing your hair. So if you take this literally, and you know, computer scientists are very good at that sort of thing, you never get out of the shower because you're not done shampooing your hair until you've done this an infinite number of times. Alright. Anyway, apparently Boy Scouts and maybe Girl Scouts sing this song often, but I first heard it on Lamb Chop's Play Along, which, no, maybe not surprisingly, was canceled. This was their theme song. And each show ended with this. This is so self-referential, right? Because not only does it not end by calling itself, but the song itself talks about the fact that it doesn't end. And not only that, but the name of it is the song that doesn't end, which is describing the song itself. And it's also a very catchy tune. So the show would be over, and I'd be well into the next cartoon before I could finally shake the song out of my head. All right, so that's sort of maybe a playful notion of what recursion is. What I'd like to do is take a few minutes and talk about a place in computer science where this is actually really powerful and really useful. So in particular, I'd like to get into talking about compilers. And this is going to help us bridge the gap between them. So we're going to talk about expression trees. It's a different way of thinking about logical expressions. So we've talked about these Boolean logical expressions, trues and falses, and ands and ors and nots. And let's say that's all there is in the world, but we can string them together in various ways. So we've got expressions like true, which is true, false, which is false, true and false, which evaluates to false, right? But it's a compound sentence. It's made up of a true, a false, and they're connected by and. And an expression like not true. And now, we've seen this way of writing it a bunch of times. I've asked you lots of clicker questions and a homework question that had this form. Here's another way of looking at what those expressions are. Let's say that true is a box, and false is a box, and true and false is an and box with two child boxes, one of which is true and the other which is false. Let's say not true is similarly a not box that has a true box underneath of it. So basically, we've got the value true, and then sitting above it, changing it, is this not. So it's just another way of reading these expressions. But I've only shown you a couple very, very simple ones. Let me show you a deeper, more complicated one. Here's, true and true is easy. But what about not true or false? Not true or false basically is an or of two things, one of which is not true, and the other of which is false. Any expression that we can write down this way, we can actually write down in more space, but maybe clearer, as a tree. Okay, the root of the tree, the top of the tree, that's a peculiarity of possibly computer science as well. We put our roots at the top. I don't know why that is. All right. The root of the tree, or the base of the tree here, is the last function that you do in evaluating the expression. And underneath of it are the things that you're combining, right? So not true or false is really oring together two different things. And we just draw it that way. We draw them as two different things, two different subtrees. Okay? Here's an even bigger one. True and true and not true or false you could actually think of as being a big and. On the one side, it's an and of true and true. And on the other side, it's a we're adding onto it or not true and false. So you can imagine building a bigger and bigger textual expression that correspond to bigger and bigger trees. So let's try to be a little bit more formal about this. Just as we can build more complicated expressions out of simpler ones, we can build more complicated trees out of simpler ones. So let's say that here's what an expression tree can be, anything at all that follows the following rules. An expression tree is either true by itself, or false by itself, or a not at the top and underneath of that some expression tree, or an and at the top and the left branch has an expression tree and the right branch has some other expression tree. Or finally, it can be an or at the top, and the left branch some expression tree, and the right branch some expression tree. Now, you might say, well, wait, did this really cover all possible expression trees? And the answer is yes, recursively, in the sense that any tree that we draw, say the one that I had on the previous slide, was has an and at the top, and then two subtrees, each of which are expression trees. How do we know that this is an expression tree? Well, it's got an and at the top, and there's two expression trees under it. But how do we know they're expression trees? Well, this one's true, and the rule said true is always an expression tree. On this side, it's true, and the rule said true is always an expression tree. What about over here? An or at the top with two expression trees underneath of it. How do we know this is an expression tree? Well, we have a rule that says you can have not with an expression tree underneath of it. Is this an expression tree? Yeah, true is always an expression tree. Under this branch, it has false. Is false an expression tree? Yes. Do we have an explicit rule for that? So just that small set of rules actually lets us say that, yes, this is a valid expression tree. This is an okay of putting these boxes and lines together because it fits the pattern that we've described. Now, we can't have like true over top of a true, like true, arrow, true. The rules don't let you do that, right? There's no way that if a true or a false is at the top of the tree, you can't have anything underneath it. So this isn't saying you can put things together any way you want. This is putting real restrictions on what you can construct. Okay. You're seeing how the connection between these, the way that you'd write this textually and the way that you would draw it as a tree? It'd be good if you could go back and forth between them. Yes, shoot.
Expressions can only come from not and or.
In this, yeah, we're defining a language where you can only have true, false, not, and or.
What if between the true, false, or not, all those, what if there was an and instead of an or? Can you have expressions coming from the true, false, true or false? Like in between the true or false, what if there was an and?
Oh, sorry. These ors are the ors in the definition. These aren't saying what an expression tree can be.
Okay.
This is saying, I can make an expression tree this way, or this way, or this way, or this way, or this way. So we should be able to take an expression and turn it into an expression tree. So let's try to do that. So if we've got something like, we've got true and not false, or true, or true, or not true. Okay? That's a perfectly reasonable expression, right? We can view this as a tree. What goes at the top of the tree? What's the last way that the pieces are being connected up? So we have, who thinks or? Who's busy writing with their hands and therefore can't raise their hands? Apparently no one. No, you did. You wrote and you raised your hand at the same time. Very good. Who thinks and needs to be at the top? Not? True? False? All right, well, or certainly carried the day. So we've got or at the top of the tree. And it's the or is always the or of two things. What are the two things? Well, this is the or we're talking about. It's this. This is the left tree, and this is the right tree. This is what we're oring together. So this, we're going to now draw this tree connected to this subbranch. So what goes at the very top of that tree?
An and.
So ands have to have two children. What's the left child?
True.
And the right child? I heard a false and I heard a not. And then some, I don't know what that sound was. What was it?
I don't know.
You're not, I don't know. We can put that at the top. It's a not And the not in particular is a not of false. Okay? And so on. And we can do this other side. It's going to have an or at the top. On the left branch is a true. And the right branch is this expression, which is an or expression. And underneath of it on the left is a true. On the other side is a not. And underneath that is a true. Whew. Okay? So this tree and that expression are the same, two ways of writing the same thing. Okay, all right. So one of the things I wanted to point out with this is just the idea that defining something recursively this way, at least you didn't run from the room, right? I don't know that everybody got all the details of this, but it's a perfectly reasonable way of making a definition. But, sure.
For the or under the or, the original or?
The or under the or?
Is that for the one in the middle, or is
this
that
one.
For the, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you don't represent, oh wait, you do represent.
This or is here.
Okay.
So everything here, the parens, notice that the parentheses don't end up being in here directly. But the parens are telling us how to group things. They're telling us which subtrees are units. So the parens really kind of are around these different pieces. So let's try one in the other direction now.
So the top or is the middle or.
This top or is, yeah, it's the middle. It's the or that's at the top of these expressions. All right, let's try to go in the other direction. So I'll give you a tree. And then write down the expression corresponding to that tree. I want you to write down what the expression corresponding to that tree is. We'll do this as a clicker question.
Aye.
Oh, was that up the whole time? Could you see that?
No.
I didn't even notice it. But anyway, yeah, see.
Sure. Good job. Hide. Stop.
Excellent. All right, good. So good. So it's really useful to be able to move back and forth between these two different ways of seeing these expressions. All right. So just I want to emphasize that in a sense this definition looks broken because it's defining an expression tree in terms of expression trees. And anybody who's done any kind of lexicography knows you're not supposed to define words in terms of themselves. But this circularity is safe, and the reason it's safe, and this is important, this is what John wanted me to ask you about earlier, the definition provides us a way to stop. So there's circularity, but there's an end case, a base case, a terminating case. And in particular, it's because true and false are valid expression trees that don't have any sub-expression trees. And because we have a way to stop, this isn't going to become an infinitely large object, right? We can always finish it off. So it's safe, but it's also necessary because there's an infinitely large set of possible expressions. So without this way of defining it, it's actually very difficult. We can't write down, I can't say, here's all the expression trees, the way that we can say with all two input Boolean functions, because there's an infinite number of them. So that would be a long definition. So having the circularity ends up being very important for capturing these structured but infinitely large sets. All right, so I've already started using some of these terms, but let me just be clear about it. The root of the tree is the node at the top. It can be true, false, not, and, or. A subtree is any tree that's underneath of the root. But they look like trees themselves, right? They look like little baby trees because they have a root and subtrees as well. The left subtree is the left one, and the right subtree is the right one. A leaf is, at the bottom, any tree that doesn't have any subtrees of its own. So it's terminal. And sometimes we'll refer to the depth of the tree, which is the number of nodes between the root and the deepest leaf, the leaf that's the farthest down from the largest number of hops away, excuse me, from the root. Okay? All right, so how do we actually figure out? Right, we've looked at these Boolean expressions and figured out their values. When it's written as a tree, how do we do that? Well, it turns out that we can evaluate these things bottom up. Right, so at the very bottom, false, true, true, true. Just a little bit above that, we've got things like, well, not true. We know that this whole subtree is just false, right? Not true is false. Do I have this animated? Oh, yeah, sorry, so I did this other one first. So anytime we go down to the bottom, we can simplify it. We can say, well, this is and true true, and true true is true, right? And true is true. So this whole subtree, even though it has its own structure to it, is really just the same as true. So we can just substitute in true on top of that whole thing and just say, it's as if we had a smaller tree that just had true there. We can now do the same thing with the not, because not true is false. What's the next thing that we can do? Can we combine this true and this false?
Not really.
Can we take care of this and yet? Not quite yet. Can we take care of this or? Some no's, some yeses. I've got half and half.
Yeah.
You're okay with that. Alright. She wasn't okay with that. Do you have a question? No, I'm just not sure yet. So or, in this case, now we've got OR of false and false, which is something that we know the answer to. So we can actually take this whole subtree rooted at the OR and say this whole subtree is equal to, what is it, false? Because false or false is false. So that whole subtree is really false. And now what can we do at the top? The whole thing is false because it's AND of true and false. Big blue triangle. All right? So we can actually get the answer to this by starting at the bottom, figuring out what all the leaves are and all the nots of the leaves and all the ands and ors of those and the ands and ors of those until we get all the way up to the top where we have the answer. Okay? So evaluating a tree is not difficult. Now, you can also sort of think of this top down. And this is where we have to put our recursive hats on again. Which, it fits some of us better than others, I guess. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, we're going to start at the root. I want to, I want to know what this left subtree is. I don't even know why I'm standing on the chair. I need to know what this left subtree is, and I need to know what the right subtree is. If you guys could tell me that, then I could tell you what the answer to the whole tree is, because it's going to be AND of those two answers. So here's what we're going to do. All right, I'm going to ask you to figure out the answer to this subtree. All right? And when you're ready, you can tell me the answer, but it's not yet. When I say when you're ready, when I tell, yeah, okay, not yet. And I'm going to ask you to figure out the answer to this subtree. But I want you, in figuring this out, don't do the whole thing yourself. Ask somebody else to tell you some piece of it. All right, so ask her. What's your name again?
Meredith.
Meredith, right. Ask Meredith to solve this piece for you. Okay, so first you, all right, so do you know the answer to your piece yet?
True.
So you're true, all right, so you're true. Now, and what are you? You don't know yet, you need to ask for help.
False.
Tell her, I don't care.
Tell false.
So you say this is false up here. All right, so now I got a true and a false, and I'm an and, so I say false. So now we've evaluated this whole thing. And all I had to think about was, you know, I know how to do an and, and I know to ask other people if these aren't true and false already, somebody else needs to figure that out and get back to me. Now, if I were recursive, I wouldn't have needed all of you guys, though I appreciate your help. Thank you very much. I would have just made another copy of me to solve this subproblem. I would have made another copy of me to solve this other subproblem. This copy of me would have asked a third copy of me to do this subproblem. They would have reported back, and then memes would have been disappearing all over the place. And then finally, I would have announced the answer. And I could have done it all myself with a little help from myself. That may or may not have been helpful. But that's sort of the weird recursive idea, right? The fact that we can solve the big problem by having other people that are not any smarter than me necessarily solve the same problem but a smaller version of it, get back to me with the answer, and I can use that answer to solve the problem I really care about. So that's kind of like evaluating this whole thing top down. Right, I got help with the left subtree, somebody helped me with the right subtree, and all I have to do is take the AND of those. Get false. Now really, this wasn't all that different. Really all we did is, ultimately, we had to get down to Meredith to solve the bottom. Right, so really we ended up doing this bottom up. But it's different. You have to think about it differently to understand that. So you can think about recursion as self-delegation, right? You just give yourself instructions and report back to yourself when you're done. But the nice thing about that is it lets you focus on what happens at the top, where things are simple. And the lower down stuff just works itself out. It ends up making for much, much cleaner algorithms, much, much cleaner programs for solving the same problem. So in particular, and I don't expect you to memorize this or do anything with this, but I just want to show you, this is a subroutine that I wrote that evaluates trees. It actually takes any expression, no matter how complicated it is, and gives the answer true or false. But the structure of it is really interesting because it's just like what we just did. Now I need the chair. So we start off, how do you evaluate a tree? Well, if the top of the tree is true, we're done. It's just true. If the top of the tree is false, we're done. It's just false. If the top of the tree is not, now we ask for help. We say, okay, somebody else go and evaluate the subtree underneath the not. So solve the bottom tree and just get back to me with the answer. I take that answer, I call it Val, and the answer that I return, what I say the final answer is the opposite of that. If the answer, if the original value of the subtree was Val, then not Val is what I return. On the other hand, if the root of the tree is AND, now I have to recruit two friends. I have one friend evaluate the left subtree, I have one friend evaluate the right subtree, and whatever answers I get back, I add them together, and that's my answer. And OR is the same way. This actually runs. I mean, you have to define what left subtree is and what right subtree is and so forth, but this is actually working code, and it's so much more pretty than what you'd have to do if you actually went find the bottom of the tree, take the bottom of the tree, solve it, replace that answer, find the new bottom of the tree. Ends up very, very complicated way of doing the same thing. So in some sense, this is very literal. It uses recursion to handle the messy lower level stuff, but in some sense, it is very, really natural, right? It's sort of the definition. When you want to do an AND, figure out what you're ANDing together, and then AND it together. It's just very direct. But it is a little bit mind-bending. I'll grant you that. All right, does anyone want to ask anything about that or read? I don't expect you to be able to write recursive code. That's not going to happen in this class. But I wanted to give you a flavor of the idea that there's something really kind of neat going on here. There's a lot of interesting structure that comes up as soon as you can name a function, and in the definition of that function, use itself.
All right, very good. All right, so I think I made it through this lecture.
You got 15 minutes.
All right, good. So I'm going to start in on the next lecture. But so here's where I want to take this next, which I'm going to do in just a moment. So don't run away yet. When we talk to computers, when we express our ideas, like that code that I just showed here, we don't talk we talk in these higher level languages, these big specifications, which computers don't directly understand. There's no circuits in the computer that directly understand Python, for example. So there's this gap. There's people writing in these high level languages like Python, and then there's the computers that run machine languages, like I showed you before. So how do you get, what bridges that gap? How do you get from a high level language that is actually executed by a machine language? So I'm not going to do that all the way through for a full language, because there's just a lot of details to it. But a lot of the interesting comes up if you just go and convert expression trees. So I'm going to show you how to compile expression trees that you can write as logical expressions and turn them into MLQ instructions, basically instructions for the machine language that I talked about a couple times ago. And that compiling is going to be recursive.
Apparently my spouse is now on the train. All right, so this is the idea of compilers.
So to lead this off, I need to now make a jump. Now that you've got expression trees more or less, I want to make them a little more complicated. Just a tiny, tiny bit. I don't think it'll be too bad. So evaluate tree, which I just described, what it does is it takes an expression tree with trues and falses at the bottom and returns true or false, the value of that whole tree. We also have looked at Boolean expressions, logical expressions, that have variables in them, like this one. Not A or B. This doesn't have a value of true or false, right? It's either true or false depending on what A and B are. So it's an expression with variables. It's kind of like algebra, the difference between arithmetic and algebra. This is a little bit more like algebra, all right? So if you knew A and B's values, so if I ask you what the value of this expression is, and by the way, A is, I forget what I chose. A is one value, B is another value. Then you can substitute them in and actually figure out what the overall value of the expression is. But first, just to be clear here, the way that I'm going to represent this expression, not A or B, is just like if it were not true or true. I have or at the top, then not underneath it on the left side, and the bottom, instead of true or false, I'll just put in A, whatever that, just a placeholder, the value of A, and over here the value of B. So not that different. But a useful way of writing things down. So if we know that A is true and B is false, now we turn it into an expression tree, we know how to evaluate this, right? We say it's the or of not of true, which is false, with false, which the whole thing is false. All right, but let's pretend that we don't know A and B. We don't know A and B, but we still want to do something useful. We can convert the expression tree into a program that, given A and B, works out the value of the expression for us. So in particular, before, when we had tree gets turned into value, now we've got tree gets turned into program. So in particular, here's that expression tree with the A's and B's in it. What we'd like to come out of this is a series of machine language instructions, like take whatever is in A, take not of it, put that in the accumulator. Take whatever's in B, or that with the accumulator, put the answer in the accumulator. This is that machine language that I talked about a couple of lectures ago. So when this is all said and done, it'll figure out not A or B, and put the answer in the accumulator. So we can turn a tree into a series of instructions that would work. You know, all you have to do is tell it A and B, and this, you run this, and it figures out the value of the expression. So that's what a compiler is. A compiler takes something like a program, in this case a logical expression, as input, an interpreter takes the program and runs it, makes it happen. That's what we were just working on before. Compiler's different. Compiler takes a program and doesn't actually do anything, it just gives you a new program. But usually it's a lower level program, like a machine language program. So we start off with a high level program, it creates a low level program. That's the sort of thing you can actually run on the computer and get something done. So this is a little sort of twisted and somewhat recursive. A program that converts a program into another program. And nevertheless, these things are really important. So here's the game plan. Game plan is, we're actually going to develop two different schemes for computing the value of an expression. One is going to work out the value and leave it in the accumulator at the end. And the other one is going to leave it in some variable that we tell it. Both of these are given a list of variables that they can use for temporary storage, and they're going to be mutually recursive. So in other words, the way that we're going to define this function is going to use this one as a subroutine, and the way we're going to define this one is going to use this function as a subroutine. All right, but I'm going to start off really, really simple. So let's start off. One kind of expression tree is one that just has a variable at the leaf. Or it's just a variable. The whole expression is just a variable. Say A. There's two ways we can compile A. We can compile A so that we make a program that figures out the value of A and leaves the answer in the accumulator. Or we can figure out A and leave the answer in some variable. Let's say P. So to leave the answer in the accumulator, we get something like accumulator equals A. That's very simple. If we want to put the answer in P, we actually have to take A, put it in the accumulator. This is because of the way our machine language works. Put it in the accumulator, then, that's not right, it's just the accumulator. Then we put, take whatever is in the accumulator and put it in P. Pay no attention to that knot. I should put conditioner on it so we get the knots out. But this one shouldn't be there. Okay? So for something very simple, like just the value of the variable, we can generate programs that do that. All right, how about something a little more complicated? Actually, maybe a lot more complicated. Now we've got an expression not of some sub-expression. In other words, we have a tree that looks like this. Not at the top, and then some tree underneath it. Here's how we're gonna turn that into code. The first thing we're gonna do is somebody else, this is not my job, turns out it is my job, but not right now, to take whatever this expression is and make a program. Generate the code, generate the program for evaluating the expression, leaving the answer in some temporary variable n. Then we're going to take the value of n, knot it, and put it in the accumulator. This is the same idea of recursion again, right? Somehow, recursively, we're going to figure out a program for creating this part of it. Then whatever the answer is, we're just going to add on to it at the end, take the value that it created, negate it, and store that in the accumulator. On the other hand, if we want the answer to end up in some variable p, we do the same thing. We just take, we leave the answer in the accumulator at the end, then we take the negation of it and put it in p. So this is code, but it's code that's kind of not completely specified because something has to recursively generate the code for the sub-expression tree for us to be able to run it. Now we're going to need some kind of pool of temporary variables for this to work, but I don't think we need to worry too much about that right now. Similarly, if we've got an expression tree that has or at the top with two sub-expressions, what we're going to do is we're going to first generate the code for the first sub-expression, and whatever, it should compute that and leave its answer in some temporary variable n. Then we put after that all the code necessary for evaluating the second sub-expression, leaving the answer in the accumulator. Now we just take the accumulator or n and store that in the accumulator. That's going to compute the value of this whole tree, as long as somebody else has generated the code for the sub-expressions for us, recursively. Alright? And similarly, if we're going to leave the answer at the end in some variable p, we generate the code for the first sub-expression, put it in p, second sub-expression, put it in the accumulator, and then store into p, accumulator, or p. So, almost all the code that's generated is the code for the sub-expressions, then we have to only add one little instruction to compute the or of the whole expression. Now I'm hearing rustling. No, it's 4:33. All right. So here's an example. We're going to work this out. Let's generate code for this expression. Not A or B. Or the expression tree form. Or not A, B. So we had a rule that said if we have or at the top, we generate, let's say we're trying to leave the answer in the accumulator. First, we generate code for this subtree, which in this case is not A. And we leave the answer in some temporary variable n. Then we generate the code for this right subtree, which is just B, leave that answer in the accumulator. Then we add an instruction at the end that takes N or the accumulator and stores it in the accumulator. All right, but this isn't a complete program yet because we didn't say how to do this. Well, how do we do that? We have a rule that says, what do you do if you're trying to do a not? If you're trying to do a not of an expression, first generate the code for the thing you're trying to compute a not for, give the answer in the accumulator, then take not of that and stick it in the variable that was your target. All right, but this is still not complete because we don't have code for this yet. We need code for taking A, leaving the answer in the accumulator, but we have a rule for that. And the rule says you just take A and you stick it in the accumulator. All right, finally we need to generate code for B, putting the answer in the accumulator. And again, we have a rule for that. Just the same, basically the same rule. And now we're done. Now we've got a full program. How many statements? It's got four statements. First, it takes A, puts it in the accumulator, negates it, puts it in N, takes B, puts it in the accumulator, takes accumulator or N, and sticks it in the accumulator. That program executes this trick. All right? We can do the same thing leaving the answer in some variable P. I won't step it through slowly, but it's really almost identical. And we're set. All right. Now the last step, if we really were going all the way to being able to run it on my machine language simulator, the last step is to take the series of instructions and turn them into the bit sequences that actually cause the machine to execute them. Usually that's called assembly. But we had, on a previous lecture, we had rules that said if you have the statement accumulator equals A, here's the bit sequence that would actually cause the machine to do that. It turns out to be the same as the number 32. N equals not accumulator is the number 125. Accumulator equals B is the number 33. Accumulator equals accumulator or N is 13. So all said and done, we started with not A or B, and we turned it into 32, 125, 33, 13, and now we'll actually run that program. Whatever A and B are, this will actually do it, leaving the answer in the accumulator. We can just run it. And presumably now, we have something that will run it really fast, because these individual instructions on a real computer are blazing. Each cycle of the computer, billions of times every second, it can do one of these little instructions. This is the complete code for the compiler, just so that I can show you that I'm not hiding anything. It's not as pretty as the other one, but it's not so bad. It fit on a slide. So I want to at least point out one thing that I probably won't be able to finish telling you about today. Here's what we just did. We took the expression not A or B and automatically generated four machine code instructions that would execute that. If you were to ask me to do it instead of my compiler program, I would have just taken two statements to do it. I would have taken not A and stored it in the accumulator, or that with B, stick it in the accumulator. Two instructions, same job, didn't have to use any temporary variables like N. It does the same thing. Two things I want to point out here. One is, even a simple expression like this, there's more than one way to get the machine to do it. There's many, many different equivalent programs that do the same work, but in different ways. And in some cases, some are faster. This is going to be faster. It only takes two cycles. In some cases, it's more wasteful of memory. This has to use some temporary variable N that nobody else can be using while we're doing this. So you can get more or less efficient versions of the same program. The other thing to point out is compilers, the more simple the compiler is, the dumber it is, the stupider the output that it produces. And you actually have to make some very sophisticated compilers to produce code that is at the level of a good program. Yeah? No. The high-level point is just that what a compiler does is generates the code. It doesn't necessarily generate good code. So what I'm going to talk about... Just keep trying to shave. I still have you for two more minutes. What I'd like to talk about next time, because I probably won't be able to concentrate enough in the last few minutes, is this idea of optimization, that you can actually speed up compiled code using some simple rules, some other programs that take the output of the compiler and play with it and make it and produce code that's even faster. It turns out that without these kind of optimizing compilers, most of the code that you run now would really be too slow to be usable. So it turns out to be very, very important that compilers go and kind of shave, throw away extra stuff, whittle the program down to something that just goes much, much faster. And now you may go. Thank you.
Did we miss
a question?
But that answer
is
in the middle.
Then you get credit. So, if anyone's curious, the way that I'm doing the attendance-related grades are: if you click on anything at all during a class period, you get 10 points for that class period. Every question that you answer within that class, you get an additional tenth of a point, I think. And every right answer you give during that class, you get 2/10 of a point. So essentially, you know, 20 right answers counts the same as showing up for a class. So you definitely want to click once each class period, because that's the lion's share. But try to get as many right answers as you can.